Okay, well, let's see what the plan is. Okay. There's two of them, and they stayed in the exact same spot the whole time. They're not colored, like I say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane.
Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
All right,
Lisa, are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, it's good to be in your ears again. Welcome to edition 464 of Strange Days Indeed. Now, my mouth is almost working properly again, and hence this program being a little tardy. The dentist told me that it'll all be fine by the time the visitors actually reveal themselves. And he obviously knows what he's talking about. Not. This time, Dave Perlot with his take on it, and then Dave and Alfred Lemberg get together for slightly longer than the last time they met on the broadcast version. Michel Deschamps joins us later to discuss some of his work in Northern Ontario here in Canada, and one heck of an interesting case up in his neck of the woods. And rounding out this edition, a taste of what UFO radio used to sound like. But more of that later. First,
these are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it, Dave Perlot.
One of the things that has always amazed me is the way discussions evolve and change, and in some instances bring facts into play that are suspect, to say the least, and outright fabrications, to say the worst. On the UFO updates list, there is a discussion that has been going on for a very long time, because it kept changing by bringing facts into play, and has some people doing what a friend of mine used to refer to as throwing FUD in the face. FUD, or fear, uncertainty, and doubt, are elements that are thrown into a discussion that makes the normal person forget about the facts at hand and instead focus on something that is altogether an unknown area for the person. The discussion in thread and question is the thread, Blanchard, Little, and Roswell, and was began because of a purported conversation between General William Blanchard and Chester Little on board an aircraft headed to the Illinois area, where General Blanchard actually told Mr. Little about what really happened near Roswell, New Mexico in July of 1947. Now, of course, whenever Roswell comes up, Major Jesse Marcel comes into the discussion along with every other witness that has been interviewed, sought out, or discovered. As a result of this, I spoke about this thread before and basically asked the same question that I've been asking ever since I learned about Roswell so many years ago. The question, how is it possible that a man holding the rank of major in the U.S. Army Air Force and being responsible for intelligence operations of the only Army Air Force base in the world with atomic weapons, would be able to get confused by rubber, aluminum foil, and balsa wood, to the point that he would believe it was a crashed flying saucer from another planet? Now, I believe as a result of my unanswered question, some people have decided to bring those things to the table, and thereby the FUD begins. Let's deal with the first part. Rubber, as used in a weather balloon, is made either from latex or chloroprene. Latex is, of course, derived from the rubber trees of South America, while chloroprene is a common name for the organic compound 2-chloro-1,3-butadiene, which has the chemical formula CH2 equals CC1 minus CH equals CH2. This colorless liquid is the monomer for the production of the polymer polychloroprene, a type of synthetic rubber. Polychloroprene is better known to the public as neoprene, the trade name DuPont gave it when the company first developed it, and currently used by DuPont Performance Elastomers. The term, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet, comes to mind. In other words, rubber is rubber, no matter what you call it or what you add to it, and no matter how badly you want to confuse someone. If you hand a person a piece of rubber and tell them that it is some metallic compound from another planet, as long as they have a functioning brain, they're going to look at you and tell you that you've lost it. Next, one of the things that have been coming into question is how balsa wood and paper could get confused with metal I-beams with symbols on them. So, someone brings up that balsa wood has been used in composite with other materials Major Marcel might not have been able to recognize if it was manufactured in that fashion. That would indicate that using balsa wood in that manner was a brand new development back in 1947. Wrong. Balsa wood is used to make very light, stiff structures in model bridge tests, and for the construction of light wooden aeroplanes, most famously the World War II de Havilland Mosquito, a British bomber. Oops, what was that? A famous World War II aircraft that was made by using balsa wood composites. Obviously, an intelligence officer in the United States Army Air Force would have absolutely no knowledge whatsoever about the wooden construction processes used in a very highly successful wooden aircraft of an allied nation. Finally, a line that was used in the thread made me smile. Only in 1947 did the Reynolds Company come up with its most famous creation, Reynolds Wrap Aluminum Foil. Accordingly, familiarity with large sheets was simply not that common, but rare. According to my research, tin was first replaced by aluminum in 1910, when the first aluminum foil rolling plant, Dr. Lober, Nieher & Company, and Emmishofen, was opened in Kreuzlingen, Switzerland. The plant, owned by J.G. Nieher & Sons, the aluminum manufacturers, started in 1886 in Schaffhausen and Switzerland at the foot of the Rhine Falls, capturing the falls' energy to produce aluminum. Nieher's sons, together with Dr. Lauber, discovered the endless rolling process and the use of aluminum foil as a protective barrier on December 1907. So obviously, it would be completely unlikely that Major Marcel would have any knowledge of aluminum foil in large quantity, because it really had only been around for a mere 40 years by then. The only thing that someone can do when someone is trying to throw FUD in your face is basically take what they say one piece at a time and check their rather suspect facts. So, regardless of the FUD, my question remains, because I still refuse to believe that a high-ranking military intelligence officer of the United States Army Air Force is an idiot. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
That's a year's worth of subscription on the big words, Dave Furlong.
Well, thank you for that.
Nice piece of research.
Thank you.
To me. And talking about nice pieces of research, a man who does a lot of research and contributes a lot to this program and to UFO Magazine. He's a musician. He's an artist. He's Alfred Lemberg. And he joins Dave Ferlot and I from his home down there in Enterprise, Alabama. Alfred Lemberg.
Greetings, my brothers.
And welcome aboard.
Well, I'm pleased as punch to be here, actually.
And it's good to have you here, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of nice being able to talk, because this is the first chance we've had to actually talk together.
Oh, for many a moon. The last time we were able to do this was the anniversary show, where there must have been like 60 people on that night. I can't remember how it was.
It was the anniversary of something.
Well, that's what anniversaries are for. Yeah,
anniversaries seem to come around every year. It's really remarkable. It's still the story of Jesse Marcel not recognizing Balsawood and Reynolds Rapp. It's pretty puzzling to me. Most of the people on UFO Updates are pretty bright and recognize the fact that Jesse Marcel absolutely had to know the difference.
Oh, yeah.
It's only the American public who back then wouldn't have known the difference.
Even then, if you hand somebody rubber, they're still going to basically think it's rubber, no matter how you cut it. So if you get to hand it something, if you got something in your hands, it's a thought process that we go through. I hand you something, and you go through a thought process, and you start trying to establish it with everything that you know. And rubber is rubber no matter what you do with it. You're going to go, well, this has got to be rubber of some nature.
Mm-hmm.
You may not necessarily recognize it as chloropolyprene or whatever, but you are going to recognize it as basically some kind of rubber.
And it seems to me that most everybody would,
mm-hmm.
except the United States Air Force in general and the United States media.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And James Bond Johnson, the photographer who was at Roswell Army Air Force Base and took those now infamous photographs of the debris from a crashed disc.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at that, if you look at the debris in the office, even in a photograph, you could tell, okay, guys, sorry, that's a weather balloon. There's no question. No ifs, ands, or buts. And you're telling me that it took how many hours? And obviously, Marcel managed to convince Blanchard that it wasn't a weather balloon. Yeah, right. Come on.
It all pretty much has to hinge on the respectability of Jesse Marcel, doesn't it? He seems to be like at the crux of this thing, and from terms of his ability to be the kind of person that we need to have to give solid credence to this thing. And I think it's interesting to look at the caliber of some of the discussions regarding his inability to have that kind of gravitas and believability. And I think all of those arguments from those people I reference are pretty easily undone.
The only reason that Jesse Marcel would pose with the photographs and basically say, yeah, this is what I discovered, ha ha, sorry guys, I wasn't able to recognize it, is he was basically told. One commanding officer to him saying, okay, here's what you are going to do, here's what you are going to say, and that's an order.
And here's what you're going to show them.
Exactly. And the military back in those days, particularly, you're given an order, you're going to follow it.
And then to 50 years later have a person like Robert Todd come along and indicate that you're a liar and a confabulator and a person not to be trusted in one of the most important and heads up above the berm and high-profile jobs you could have.
Yeah, exactly. It's, again, one of those situations where you're looking at it, and it's like, okay, guys, let's recognize the fact that, yes, he had to follow those orders. He is not lying to us. He was doing what he had to do. The fact of the matter is, that doesn't make him stupid. That doesn't make him a stooge. That makes him simply a military officer that had to follow his orders. And let's look at it realistically. And realistically, he had to follow his orders, but we have to recognize the fact that there is no way in hell that this gentleman was incapable of recognizing what everything was originally.
Why would he have bothered to take it home and show his wife and son?
Exactly. Obviously, he had to be the one to convince Blanchard to tell how to issue that press release. It just goes from there.
It's still all a mystery to all of us.
It is indeed. I'm not saying for sure that what crashed in Roswell in July of 47 was a crashed alien spaceship. But I do know that it definitely was not the debris that was in that office, and it definitely was not any kind of weather balloon or quantity of weather balloons constructed into a mogul balloon array or whatever the hell it was. It definitely was not that, because there's no way that he would not know what that was.
You'd think.
Mm-hmm.
Did we pretty much cover Roswell this time?
I think so. I think we've covered it off.
A few hundred times in 460-something programs.
We have to keep covering it off because we keep getting newcomers all the time. And we have to reinforce in them, think, use your brains. And when you do get people coming up with confusing facts that they pull out of their nether regions, shall we say, then it behooves us to basically go and do the research and come up with the stuff that's basically refute their particular quote-unquote facts.
Those not found in the nether regions.
Yes, exactly. So, onwards and sideways.
Okay, onwards and sideways. I just wanted to mention a couple of things. I just got in the mail the September-October issue of Fate magazine. The 700th issue. 700 editions of Fate magazine.
That's wow. Scary.
Can you imagine, huh, how long that's been going? Phyllis Galdi and the gang down there in Minnesota, congratulations on the 700th
yes.
edition of Fate magazine.
Big.
Great work.
Good stuff.
And it's a pretty astounding achievement, given just how twitchy it all is and how difficult it is to keep an interest in things that can be ultimately unsettling and disturbing.
And for those of you who have never seen Fate magazine, do yourselves a favor and go to fatemag.com and avail yourselves of a free issue, which they will send you in the mail. And it covers all the things that interest me, and then some. Technology moves onward, gentlemen. We have, the three of us, been experimenting at paltalk.com with our video cameras and our audio, online chat.
Yes, definitely, and probably one of the best chat program bases out there. It allows us the flexibility to get together, put up our cams.
And it had occurred to me the other day that it would be an interesting thing to do to set up a chat room there using audio and video, but primarily audio so that we can record it and play it back on future editions of Strange Days Indeed. If you go, well, of course, you've already been to the current program listing, and there you will find a link to Pal Talk should you like to join us on a regular basis.
Exactly. We can set it up so that room is always open.
We will set up a specific date and time for us to gather there.
Oh, definitely.
And
yes.
Record listeners to the program for inclusion in future podcasts, as I said. So paltalk.com if you want to go sign up. You don't have to have a camera. As long as you've got a headset and a microphone, that will really work well. Video doesn't matter for this program at the moment, although that may change one day.
But the big key is, yes, please have a microphone and sound system so you can at least hear us. But by the same token, it's also not 100% necessary because, of course, you can always type and put questions in the room like that. But we would prefer that you could actually, at the very least, hear us because most of the stuff we're going to be doing will be talking.
And, of course, the room will be moderated.
Exactly.
Okay, enough of the plugs for Pal Talk. Let us discuss a couple of items here. Anybody know whatever happened to O'Hare?
That's a good question. What has been happening?
2 years ago now, over the United Airlines terminal, for those of you who have been living in a cave and didn't take your MP3 player with you, O'Hare International Airport, around this time, actually November, 2 years ago, a large disc hovering under a cloudy sky over the United Airlines terminal, and as Dave said, it took off, punched a hole in the cloud, which stayed there. And, of course, the FAA said it was a weather anomaly. And, of course, the Federal Aviation Authority is absolutely qualified to identify a very odd phenomena like a hole punched in a cloud by a UFO as a weather anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they didn't hesitate to use their complete lack of qualifications to make that weather anomaly pronunciation.
Oh, yeah. They picked at that one real fast and just sort of went, that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, we have United Airline employees telling us that they were told to not talk about it. Ooh.
And, of course, like all of the major stories in ufology, they disappear and nothing ever happens again.
Mm-hmm. So hopefully somebody out there is doing a little bit of legwork and going to follow this one up in depth.
Well, don't you kind of think that it has fallen so far out of discussion probably is because it is such a good story and such an indicator that something really highly strange actually occurred?
And that's one of the reasons. Because we have so many, for all intents and purposes, qualified witnesses. People who see aerial craft every single day that they are working. So, yeah, they wouldn't be able to recognize any kind of strange aerial phenomena that just happens to go by because they're never looking at that kind of stuff. Right.
It's much the same as the flappers summer of 1952 that Frank Fascino has been working on for so many years, and Alfred never hesitates to talk about.
Well, I'm one of the few, too, I think.
Well, yeah, it seems to me.
My lack of hesitation.
Frank Fascino, Stan Friedman, and yourself.
With so many sightings of so many craft all over North America during that particular summer, including even in Washington himself, Frank Fascino has done a magnificent job of covering that off for us.
He really has. I think that is pretty inarguable, and over a period of many years with some degree of journalistic integrity, I think. Really trying to look at the facts and really not trying to rush too far afield and speculation or conjecture or anything like that. He kind of hews a pretty close row that is impressing more persons than myself, and just lately too. Persons like Jim Mars and Whitley Strieber and among significant others are becoming interested in this pretty strange thing when you consider, were we in some kind of armed conflict with alien beings from another planet? Is that even possible?
If you look at the number of sightings that Frank has documented, I'd say definitely we were. The U.S. Air Force was actually given orders to shoot some of these things down. That's pretty serious.
And what hubris, too, when you think about it for a second there, what prepossessed us to think that we could go out and engage persons who could travel to us from conceivably another planet, even if it was just the moon, for God's sakes, it was way ahead of our capability. What made us think that we had the gravitas to pull something like that off?
To my way of thinking, it's just that was our only option. If they were actually threatening or firing at us, then that was basically our only option.
True.
But the big key that you have is also as part and parcel of that whole flap was the whole thing around Washington. In the United States, these things flitting around the airspace of Washington is akin to a declaration of war almost.
You're right. I can't argue with that at all. But still, to pop off at them with some 20-millimeter or some 2.75 folding thin aerial rockets, or to be sitting on the active runway, scrambled with orders that you know you have to go out and shoot at these damn things. I mean, what a concept. What a history.
It falls hand in hand with the thing that we've seen just recently emerge in the news with the documents coming from the MOD over in Britain, with the fact that there was a U.S. pilot that was ordered to shoot at a UFO over the North Sea.
These are some of the records you're talking about that had enough asbestos scraped off of them or something?
Mm-hmm. The same ones.
Well, actually, when that came up, and they said, oh, there are, all of these records have got asbestos dust, and they're a toxic site now, and we have to pay special attention, and blah, blah, blah. I thought, that's it. We'll never see those things again. So it was really interesting to have them pop up later on, and especially in a way that is so apparently tumultuous. What do you think, huh?
Well, it certainly makes the headlines in the UK, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, and getting into mainstream media the way it did. That's the big key, is the fact that the information that's coming out of these particular documents is getting out into mainstream media.
And to have the guy still living in Miami backed up by official documents just released, that's a killer.
Yeah, that is the killer, because now all of a sudden we can actually talk to this person. This is not somebody that died that we have to go from he said, she said. Now we can actually get them on camera, on microphone, and so tell us what happened. Tell us, what were you told?
From what I have heard of his story, it's pretty spectacular, including radar returns on craft that may have been as big as aircraft carriers.
Wow. Anything that's as big as an aircraft carrier that can fly around in our skies, I'm sorry, guys, that scares me.
Yeah, I'm not ready for that. Thank you very much. The discussion about it actually on UFO Updates and the retired U.S. military pilot has been quite strong on the list. Several people, including Don Ledger, have suggested that they wouldn't be firing off missiles when you're that close to built-up areas. You have to wonder about that story, you know?
Again, by the same token, if he was in fact given those orders being that close to built-up areas, like being so close to London.
Yeah, about 75 miles or 120 clicks from central London.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And if he was, in fact, given those orders were not given lightly. It'd be similar to engaging enemy aircraft over Washington or over Ottawa or any capital city.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to just, okay, yeah, let's just launch a missile here and see what happens. Oh, hell no.
No, it wasn't just a missile. Milton Torres is the retired pilot's name. He said he was ordered to fly at full throttle in cloudy weather and was given the order to fire a volley of 24 rockets at the mystery object.
Yeah, and back in those times, those particular rockets didn't have any internal guidance. Once you launch them...
Yeah, they went straight ahead
until they ran out of juice.
There was nothing to jam or control.
Yeah.
Yeah. His reaction was, he said, to be quite candid, I almost expletive my pants.
Oh, yeah.
Saying he asked for confirmation, which he received.
And that is typical standard operating procedure, is you get an order, shall I engage? Yes, you are cleared to engage. Confirm. You want me to engage this target? Confirmation, yes.
It's a pretty astounding story. And the way that the Ministry of Defense is releasing all of its UFO files, because it's had so much pressure under the British Freedom of Information Act over there, and they've just gotten tired of it, apparently, and are releasing documents piecemeal as they go through and redact them and take out names to protect witnesses. So this is going to go on for several years, but it seems in the first couple of batches that have come out of there, there's been some pretty sensational stuff.
Oh, yeah. Even with the redacting, because we see similar types of documents from the CIA, and it's like you can read four words on a page. It's like, come on, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the skeptic bunkies keep making fun of Friedman pointing that out, but it's absolutely true. Whatever it is being covered up is being covered up. I don't care.
Oh, yeah. The Freedom of Information Act, in a lot of ways, is a bit of a joke because it's like, okay, well, you want this document? Fine. We'll just redact all of this stuff here. And there you go. Now you have it. And you can read, we, they, said. And it's like, okay, great, thanks. That was very helpful, guys.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you got some real action in that one. Like, you know, they're usually a lot more obtuse than that. Like, it.
Yeah.
And the. You know, okay, now let's work with that. I could drag a whole conspiracy out of that puppy.
You mentioned the skeptibunking machine, Alfred.
The well-moneyed skeptibunking machine with its own publishing houses and stable of authors, and like the right wing down here in the United States has Ann Coulter.
And ufology has Michael Shermer and Bill Nye the Science Guy.
He's the most recent poster child, but we've got to give special consideration to guys like Mr. Magaha and Dr. Joe Nichols. I think Seth Shostak.
And let's not forget the spokespuppy, James Oberg.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. The guy who by the way, I don't think we need to tell you about my active duty association with military intelligence while I'm debunking all of these things you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Who likes to basically come out and say, oh, yeah, that was a, let's see, what was that? Oh, yeah, that was a Russian spacecraft taking off on its flight. Yeah, that's what they saw.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and ice crystals zipping up out of the Earth's atmosphere.
Of course.
Another
yeah.
favorite.
Yeah, those were supersonic ice crystals that were following the aircraft.
How about this most recent one with Dr. David Clark from England and his presupposing on what UFOs are and are not?
I actually like David Clark. I've had him on this program, and I don't know whether you gentlemen have listened to those interviews.
Oh, indeed. Very charming as he presupposes and makes his own assumptions about how things must be.
Yeah, it's always an interesting situation when somebody comes along who is a skeptibunker who does do some of these things.
Do you think he's a skeptibunker, Dave?
To a certain degree.
Yeah.
With some of these gentlemen, they come along, they sound very, very charming and very straightforward.
I knew it.
Even when we talked to Joe Nichol, he did sound very nice and very relaxed, but he was obviously a skeptibunker. Mm. You know it, I know it.
I like Phil Klass, too, when I met him down in New York.
Did you really?
Yeah. MUFON Ontario decided that they would attend the National Conference of PSYCOP, which was happening at the University of, what is it, outside Buffalo, Amherst University in New York.
So what a concept.
We showed up there, and they were just blown away that we had the temerity to do that. It was very odd. Had a good time down there. I had a bit of fun, had some discussions with McGay Hay. I spent some time, along with Sue Kovios, talking to Phil Klass outside, and that was after Sue had overheard outside also, and Klass didn't know who she was at that time, telling another attendee that he'd had a UFO experience.
Phil Klass.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Though apparently he never did admit to it publicly.
Well, of course not. That would have sent shockwaves like mad through PSYCOP.
That's the first halfway benign story I've heard about Phil Klass, because all the other things that I've heard about him, the guy makes inappropriate comments almost to the point where he's hitting on your girlfriend if she's with you. Greg Sandow tells that story on UFO Updates.
There were a lot of stories told about Phil Klass on UFO Updates.
I like to think I've told a few myself.
Klass was a likable rogue. You know, he was kind of like Errol Flynn. Yeah, he was a very pleasant man. He was very nice. He was very polite. He made us laugh. We made him laugh. And then we brought up a couple of unfortunate things that didn't make him laugh. And off he went.
Yeah, it's the off you went part that would get to me, I think. Mm-hmm. The literary pistols that have added at dawn, for my money, just took such great pains to go to such great lengths to keep us from looking beyond the ends of our own noses.
And to destroy the careers of several people.
Yeah, and you find out about more and more of them all the time. Mm-hmm. The most recent one I just heard of was that fellow that was photographing missiles.
Bob Jacobs, you mean?
Bob Jacobs, that's
yeah,
Dr.
Yeah.
Bob
Professor
Jacobs,
Bob
that's right.
Jacobs, yeah.
He lost his job, teaching credential or a teaching position or something like that, as a result of class taking a special interest in him.
That's the age-old situation. If you get people that are teaching in teaching positions, and if you portray them the wrong way, then all of a sudden it becomes, do you really want this person teaching your children?
It's not Dude, I hear that.
With the Skeptobunkers and with the reports that are surfacing, is anyone going to truly care when UFOs are finally revealed to be exactly whatever it is that they are? Or are we just going to get a, oh, yeah, okay, well, yeah, that's nice. I got to get back to work here, guys.
Well, I think we don't hear about it, Dave, because it gives some significance to how important it is to rank-and-file individuals, I think. I suspect that the rank-and-file individual is to be plussed up, even if some reptilian corporate behemoths have got to be shut down. And I realize how that sounds on the face of it, but I'm talking about technological things, you know, like this nanotechnology that we're just beginning to get the basic grips with. And it would be kind of nice to have a little nanorobot cruise into the old bod and fix you from the inside out. I think that and things like that are in our future with regard to what can be gleaned from an alien association of some type that I can't even, you know, begin to define for you.
Mm. Well, that's disappointing.
See, if I could begin to define it for you, then I think I would, okay, Lindbergh slid off the deep end, or further than even I had estimated.
So you're buying into the exchange of technologies, or the acceptance of technologies from technologically advanced races, if we encounter them.
Well, when buying into it, I'm not sure I want to go that far, but I'm thinking it's a real potentiality given it may be some aspect of the technologies we enjoy right now might have some kind of alien infusion on their own, perhaps, possibly.
We have come a long ways if you take a look at our technological advances.
An exponential asymptotic way.
Oh, yeah. Take a look at what we accomplished from, say, 1600 to 1900, and then compare it to what we accomplished from 1900 to 2000, it's like, wow.
I myself am dazzled by the last 10 years. Man, things have gotten crazy in 10 years. There are things going on now that weren't even science fiction 10 years ago.
Oh, agreed. We've got kids going into college. They have no idea what a record player or a vinyl record even looks like.
My son laughs at my collection, and he's 30.
Yeah, you take a look at some of this stuff, and you go, wow, the stuff that we thought was state-of-the-art when we were their age is not even around anymore.
Yeah.
It's long gone.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think podcasts were around when I first started doing Strange Days Indeed.
No, the explosion of the Internet in general. Being able to do stuff like go on to something like a Pal Talk and be able to talk and speak with somebody half a world away in real time is all fairly new to everyone. And being able to do that for free, that's another thing.
Free?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the whole
thing. Well, why did I give you all that money, Dave? Talking of kids, Alfred Lemberg, you were telling me about a young girl that you met when you were in West Virginia at the Flatwoods Monster Gathering.
Yes, around September 12th, the anniversary of the Flatwoods Monster incident, there was a little girl up there that was introduced to the audience that had won a regional science fair for persons her age, and she's 11 years old. very precocious and very interested and interesting 11-year-old. I found her really, really captivating, just the delight in every way. What her program was, she was interested in the Flatwoods Monster Affair and if it was really an actual occurrence or not. She had questions like that and got interested in the entire aspect of it. And her mother had been reading Frank Fascino's book, Shoot Them Down, about the Flatwoods Monster incident. One thing just led to another, and the little girl ends up calling one of the principal witnesses to the Flatwoods Affair, Eddie May, interviews him for this thing, and makes a little project and puts it all together and wins regional awards. Well, I allowed to her while I was down there. I said, you know, like, if you'd like to just make a little statement from an 11-year-old perspective, we'll respect you. And, you know, what do you think of all this stuff, and why are you interested? And she wrote me this little essay.
If you got it there, Alfred, why don't you read it to us?
By the way, I should tell you her name is Alexis Loudon, and her nickname is Lexi. She likes to be called Lexi Loudon.
Hi, Lexi.
Yeah, I'm sure she'll be listening.
You're going to send her a copy of this, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Good.
So, at any rate, she writes. And she apparently only wrote this when she was 10 years old, so I was all messed up on her being 11. Because she starts out and she says, I'm only 10 years old, so I never really thought about UFOs or aliens until I started doing research for my Flatwoods Monster project. Before I started, I thought it was just a big hoax. After all, parents always tell their kids there's no such thing as monsters. I started reading on the internet and in books, and it seemed the more I found out, the more questions I had. I decided to contact Mr. Freddie May, who was an eyewitness to the Flatwoods Monster. Mr. May was nice enough to give me his account of what happened, and he let me ask him questions about things I wanted to know. In my project, I was asked for my conclusion about the Flatwoods Monster. I gave it a lot of thought, and I came to the conclusion that I believe that UFOs are very real, and I think the government spends a lot of time and money trying to cover up all the sightings and the findings. I think there is too much evidence to say it is just mass hysteria. I think there are spaceships from other planets, and I also believe that they will continue to visit our planet. I feel like my project has changed my life, because now, when I look up at the stars at night, I find myself looking for a flashing light or something that doesn't belong. I've gotten a lot of new friends who showed me proof that UFOs do exist, and I hope to continue to research this subject because it is really interesting. The end.
Phew. 10 years old. Huh?
10 years old, yeah.
Out of the mouths of babes come pearls of wisdom.
And I get the impression, really, having met this little girl and seen what she put together on her own and what she was able to say and behave just right in front of me, that I think she had a big hand in writing all of that herself and not a whole lot of help from her mom.
Remember that name, folks. Say it again for us, Alfred.
Lexi Loudon.
Lexi Loudon.
Yeah, sounds like a girlfriend of Superman, doesn't it?
10 or 15 years and she'll be the fifth generation UFO researcher.
Exactly.
Yep.
Assuming, of course, that within 10 or 15 years we still don't know.
Yeah, or within 10 or 15 years we are still here.
Well, and you may mean that in a good way, too, because with this acceleration to a concrescence of all things and these asymptotic measurable curves that we see just getting faster and faster to the point of hyperspace, what have we got but maybe just a forward escape? The three of us certainly into this brand new future that really is the 21st century and, you know, really is living expansively, intellectually. Who's to say? Things are really heating up to that point where you can't look and predict even 5 years into the future anymore about how things are going to be.
And we're only 3 years away from 2012.
Exactly. And there's a machine working away.
The Hadron Collider.
Yes.
Yeah, well, we've talked about that of late, too.
Did anybody else see that short film of the Hadron Collider making a black hole?
Yes.
Oh, man. It was just so incredible. It just sucking up everything in super quick motion. It was horrifying, actually.
Mm-hmm.
On YouTube.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, I think we have covered off a couple of things that perhaps needed to be covered off in this edition of the program. Any closing words, thoughts, observations, or questions, either of you?
For myself, I think it would basically become a line of everything that you hear and read and see in regard to UFOs, particularly when it comes to some of the people making claims about various facts, examine them all. Ask questions. Question it endlessly, because you may be surprised at the answers you get.
Yeah, don't accept what is not acceptable, and be ready to embrace what is embraceable, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Put your head between your knees and repeat after me.
I don't think I can do that anymore.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
As always, it was good, and we will talk to both of you very soon. Alfred Lemberg, down there in Alabama.
Auf Wiedersehen, mein Herr.
Auf Wiedersehen, Dave Verlott, just outside Toronto, here in Canada, next time.
For sure.
Michel Deschamps is a researcher-investigator in Sudbury, Ontario, which is a few hours' drive north of Toronto. He's spent years sifting through newspapers looking for UFO-related reports covering northern Ontario, and he's posted the results of that research to his newish website, newfors.com, the Northern Ontario UFO Research and Study website. The site actually has a staggering amount of Northern Ontario-related UFO activity and a whole bunch of other UFO information. And one of the most intriguing cases that's happened in Michel's area, other than Michel's own many sightings, which we may or may not get into, was the Falconbridge case. At Michel's website is an excerpt from the 1979 book UFO Canada by Yurko Bunderchuk, and it says, Falconbridge Canadian Forces Radar Station, Sudbury, Ontario, November the 11th, 1975. One of the longest and most controversial UFO sightings ever recorded by radar personnel happened in the Sudbury area in northern Ontario. The appearance of unidentified craft on November 11th in 75 prompted NORAD officials to send military jet interceptors to investigate. And despite denials, this move clearly exposed the government's interest in exploring the phenomenon. The Sudbury sightings coincided with an unprecedented week-long flurry of UFO activity over key military installations in both Canada and the United States. Let's bring Michel into this. On the line from his home in Sudbury is Michel Deschamps. Bonjour for sure, Michel.
Salut, Errol.
An intriguing, as I said, the Falconbridge radar station case. And you actually weren't involved in the original investigation of the case, but you became intrigued as you came across stories of it in the local papers over the years.
As a matter of fact, I vaguely remember 75. I was in grade school, and although I don't personally remember it, some of the other residents in Hanmer actually heard the sirens that went off from the radar base on that particular day. And I said, wow, like an alert siren? And I don't remember hearing that. But when I first got word of all these clippings in the Sudbury Star, I started looking, and of course I started back in June of 47. And when I came up to the 70s, not only did I find some clippings about the radar base, but there was also sightings that led up to the month of November, starting in August of 75, in Shiguindo on Manitoulin Island. Sightings there, also a sighting over Lake Ramsey. Manitoulin UFO sighted a 10th time. Police see light. The police officers in North Bay saw a light. So also have a clipping on November 3rd, 1975, two UFO sightings over Lake Nipissing Island leave OPP civilian observers baffled. And as we get closer to, of course, today, which is the anniversary, November 11th, radar-based police see UFO here. And headlines for the following day, November 12th, U.S. jets scrambled on UFOs, more sightings reported, radar base won't comment.
Well, of course they won't comment.
No. Not at the time. And I never thought that I would ever hear from somebody who actually worked there, but basically going through the clippings, in the early 90s, my former colleague Todd Frazier and I proceeded to inquire about some information regarding UFOs to the National Archives. And here we were, filling out regular Information Act requests. I guess when Todd made a call to the National Archives, he spoke to a lady there, and she says, well, didn't you know that those microfilm reels are available? And so Todd turned to me and says, yeah, why the hell are we filling these out when you could just maybe buy these microfilm reels? So we went ahead and we bought them. At the time, there was only five that were available, 16-millimeter film, and each going for about $24. So we bought all five and proceeded to look through them from early 50s. And when we got to the 70s, we found 12 documents that pertained to the radar base. And it included names of corporals that saw the object or were trained as radar technicians at the radar base. Matter of fact, more recently I did get a chance to actually speak with a radar technician, and his name is in three of the documents.
Can you piece the event together for us?
Yeah, we're thinking now it's more like it was four objects in total, it seems like. The first people to report the sighting was a nursing staff at Pioneer Manor. That's a nursing home. Six nurses. It says in the documents they wish to remain anonymous. There was also additional witnesses, Sudbury Regional Police. They were on the follow-up report. They said basically the object seemed to hover over Sudbury Stadium. I remember that baseball park. Constable Keebles and Whiteside. Whiteside actually was a friend of Don Campbell, UFO Don. So, of course, the police officers would more likely have told them about these sightings, too. Here's a Constable Marsh. Sudbury Regional Police, again, was on patrol near Highway 17 East. He was observing it southeast of Coniston. One very bright star-like object moving in a jerky circular manner. When covered with clouds, it was still bright enough to shine through as well as light up an area around it. While observing this object, he saw two other similar objects, one in the south and one southwest of Coniston. All seemed to be moving in a jerky circular manner. And they also seemed to emit a pulsating type of light varying in colors, easily distinguishable from the stars. Here we have Master Corporal Krutz and Corporal Lauritsen from CSS Falconbridge. Corporal Lauritsen is actually the radar technician that got a hold of me. It says here they looked at the object and it says, appeared to be a very bright stationary light at approximately 30,000 feet. Sighting lasted about 30 seconds, was first observed by Sudbury Police to be overhead Falconbridge, the town of Falconbridge. There's also a town of Falconbridge, but it's not exactly located to where the radar base is. The radar base is halfway between Hanmer and Sudbury. Between the radar base and Sudbury, there's the town of Falconbridge and the town of Garson. One bright object appeared to be over the north and of the city of Sudbury, moving in a northwesterly direction at a high rate of speed. And then it was seen for a minute and then covered by a large cloud. Again, November 11th. Circular object seen by Captain Carson, Master Corporal Krutz, and Corporal Lauritsen. Circular object brilliantly lighted with two black spots in the center, moving upwards at high speed from 42,000 feet to 72,000 feet. No horizontal movement. This object was sighted visually and by radar, bearing 210 degrees magnetic at 30 nautical miles from CFS Falconbridge. Major Oliver took pictures but is not sure if they will turn out. A similar object was sighted by the same observers bearing 270 degrees magnetic, but at too great a distance to provide details. Many other reports were received from Sudbury, Ontario Provincial Police.
The photographs that were taken,
yeah.
Did they turn out?
We don't know.
We don't know.
We don't know. I don't think they were ever released.
Having read the information on Falcon Bridge at your website, it seems to me that there had been announcements of the fact that the photographs were taken.
Yeah.
At least according to Yurko Bunderchuk.
Yeah. You got two stories. You got the stories from the documents and Yurko Bunderchuk, and you got the other story put up by the Sudbury Star. Well, the Sudbury Star had been told that some photos were being released, so they showed up the next day to see. It almost sounds like what happened with Roswell. The one day the story came out, the next day everything was denied. Well, the same thing with this case. As the reporters had been told that photos were going to be released, they had shown up at a certain spot, and then it was basically denied that any photos were ever taken, much less ever came out or turned out. Okay. So the story is varied in the newspaper compared to what it says in the documents. In the papers, it basically made it look like the sightings were very vague. But when you got the document talking about an object that had the surface texture of the moon, craters and dimples, spherical shaped and appeared to be rotating, ascending and descending, the sighting lasted 2 hours intermittently due to cloud cover, and it was observed on height finder radar and search radar, so two different types of radar. In the Sudbury Star, well, it didn't quite go into detail, so Corporal Lauritsen was telling me that that's the discrepancy he wanted to straighten out. The papers seemed to indicate that the same thing they picked up on radar was what was being seen by the cops and the nurses, but those objects were particularly too low for the radar to pick up. It would have been lost in the ground clutter.
Mm-hmm.
Because apparently they can pick up ground clutter like buildings, trees, and hills, like below 10,000 feet.
And they don't usually set the radar up so that it scans at below 10,000 feet.
But this object was further out than these other ones. This Master Corporal that had the binoculars, he was a trained observer. He was a pilot. And so he noticed the texture on the craft, but Corporal Ortson said that he couldn't make out the details, but he's trained as a radar technician. He's not trained to be a trained observer through binoculars. And so that's where the discrepancy is between the papers. If they've said a different story about there's pictures released, said there was no pictures taken, and yet in the documents it mentions right there that pictures were taken.
I wonder where Bunderchuk got his information from, because in his book, UFOs Over Canada, and you had the excerpt at your website, he says the objects were photographed by the base staff. And then later that afternoon, Sudbury Star reporters were advised by the Public Information Office, the PIO, at Defense Headquarters in Ottawa, that the photos would soon be released to the press.
Yeah.
And then that was corroborated by Falcon Bridge radar station personnel, Bunderchuk says, who indicated that the developed prints would be available the following morning. And then when the station's base commander, Major Oliver, made a surprise announcement, he said there have been no photographs taken nor any messages sent to Ottawa that mentioned photographs. He said he had investigated and had found no one had grabbed a camera. As you say, it's like Roswell. Here's the debris that we actually found.
You know what? I never even thought about that. It's just, where did Yurko Bunderchuk, who is a source of information. Obviously, he got some really good information for his book.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody was asking me, as a matter of fact, regarding my website, where did you get all those sketches from? Well, I have Yurko Bunderchuk's book both in English and French. And in the French book, it had all these sketches, including sketches of one of the objects seen over the radar base. And they also had a photograph of an F-106 interceptor from the Air National Guard, which was Selfridge, Michigan, that they were sent from.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the photo of Major Oliver was in the book, too.
Yurko Bunderchuk has, over the years, disappeared. He was a prof at McGill University at the time the book came out, and nobody seems to know where he is now.
Well, I don't know for sure if there is any subsequent sightings that took place after 75 that were not even witnessed by myself. But whether there were, I wouldn't be surprised until the base closed in 1986 and 87. The reason I know this is because living close to the base, 4.5 miles away, we snuck up there a couple of times once the place was abandoned. It was pretty cool. In one documentary, as a matter of fact, we were talking about not just Falcon Bridge, but the same time that Falcon Bridge was happening, there was also intrusions of UFOs or mysterious helicopters over Loring Air Force Base in Maine, Wurtsmith Air Force Base in Michigan, Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, and Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. But I never thought that I'd see something at the base. I mean, once it was closed in October of 1990, that's the very same year that I met Don Campbell that very summer. He had lent me some old Flying Saucer magazines, and he wasn't really willing to give them to me, so I said, well, I've got to make photocopies. But I was working at a car dealership at the time. I was finishing doing the photocopies. I was there from 8 o'clock to 8:30. And as I'm walking out, I see this object, and I thought at first it was Jupiter. Extremely bright, and like lots of strings of light coming off of it. And I said, what the hell is that? So I walked back, I talked to one of the salespeople, and I had him come and take a look. Well, he didn't even have to go outside. He just came up to the window, and you could see the object. And he just looked at it, shrugged his shoulders, and walked off. So I said, well, I'm going to go and check to see what this is. So I get in the car, go down the hill, and as I'm looking to my right, between the houses, I could still see the object. Get to the house, and I'm all excited, and I say, Dad, I think there's a flying saucer flying in Sudbury. Grabbed my binoculars and went to the neighboring street. The trees were bare. I could see the object, and by then it looked like a little white egg. There was no more dissipating light coming off of it, and it went from side to side. I stood there, and sometimes eyes can play tricks on you, but I swear that this thing just moved a little bit to the left and right about three times, and it stopped. And then it blinks out, and then I'm freaking out because I said, that must have moved. There's a branch in the way, so I crouch a little lower, and it's not there. And then a few seconds later, it reappears, but at a lower elevation than it was. But it was still over the hills in the distance. I knew that. I said, I got to go to a place where I can get another good view of the whole valley. So I went to a neighboring hill, and I had my binoculars with me. I'm just panning from west to east. And as I get to where the base is located, I see this big reddish, pinkish, pulsating light, maybe 50, 60 feet off the top of the hill. Couldn't see the base. This was like 8:30, almost getting close to quarter to nine. But the lampposts along the highway, from that, I could tell where the base was. And this thing was there, and then the hairs at the back of my neck stood up. My knees started to buckle, so I put my elbows on my rooftop to stabilize the binoculars, and I looked at this thing. I don't know, maybe 5 minutes. And it seemed like it was going to stay there. So I said, well, stupid me. I said, I got to get witnesses. I said, no witnesses was the one reason why a lot of people kicked themselves when they had a sighting, is because they have nobody else to tell about. So I stupidly put all my blinkers on, my hazard lights, and I drove like an idiot back to the house to try to get somebody, and went back with my mom, and the object was gone. To tell you the truth, I've been kicking myself ever since.
Was this while the base was still open?
No, it was closed.
Ah.
It was closed. This was October 1990, and my personal assumption was that these guys were obviously at the time in 75, they must have known, just like our jet fighters are able to tell when they have a radar lock on them. They must have been able to tell that the radar was operating and tracking them. So I'm just assuming that they were just checking out why is the base no longer operating, because they hovered near there, like, real close. It was actually bigger than a car, because through the binoculars, it was exactly the same width as one of large cube building at the radar base. And later on, I took a couple of reporters from the south side story there. We proceeded to measure the building one side and the other, and was 40 feet by 40 feet. So I'm assuming that the object that was hovering there that night was approximately the same size. I tried to call, of course, the only person I trust that would believe me would be UFO Don Campbell.
The local UFO investigator before you.
Well, actually, he was not a UFO investigator. He was a non-believer in the 50s when the Garson mine incident took place with the landing and the three 13-foot tall beings. He used to laugh at the report in the papers. But then he went and investigated Garson, and he saw a military helicopter and a whole bunch of stuff. The audio clip's on my website, so people can actually listen to the story itself. But he was a non-believer then, but then he just became so intrigued with it. His work shift actually allowed him the time to go around when these things would show up, and they would show up mostly after midnight. And him and his partner, who believed him from the first time he had his first sighting, they'd go out and they'd see these things in, over Sudbury, like at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning when most people would be sleeping. But I met him that same summer, and so I thought, well, he's the only person who's going to believe me. So I tried calling him on my mom's phone, but there was static on the phone like you wouldn't believe. I couldn't call out. I couldn't figure out why. And so I had to drive to the Hanmer Tavern, just a small bar, and there was a payphone outside. I got on the payphone, no problem. called him up, told him about the sighting. And then as I'm looking up in the sky, I see this small Cessna. And another assumption came into mind. I says, man, I says, I wonder if that's what made the UFO blink itself out, to let the plane pass by. And then once the plane was gone, the UFO would blink itself on again, because I'd heard similar reports, including Malmstrom Air Force Base, where this 300-foot disc was over the missile silos, and a helicopter pilot and some jet fighters went over. The UFO blinked itself off. The jets went around in circles, said there's nothing here. They headed back to the base, and then the UFO turned itself on and then took off. So I thought, well, maybe this would happen. You know, in the time when I saw the little egg-shaped object disappear and I couldn't see it in view, and then it reappeared a little lower. It must have left the plane go by, because the airport's not being that far from the radar base. But anyways, I told the story to Don, and he believed me. And I was still, like, the hairs of the back of my neck was still raised, and that was my sighting at the base. After that, I stood out in fields over there by the radar base looking for UFOs, flashing flashlight. I almost flagged an airplane down. That's the only mistake I ever made. Then I knew that if you want to identify a UFO, you got to stay out there at least 30 minutes to an hour to make sure that once the plane passes over you, you can hear the sound, you can see the international beacon, you can see the red and blue lights on the wingtips, and recognize that as what for what it is. So, yeah, I learned quite a lot from that sighting.
Michel, all of that you've talked about, plus a whole bazunch more stuff, is at your website.
Yeah.
And people can go read and they can go listen, because there's all kinds of audio there, too.
Yeah.
You have said there is much more to the story than what we've had time to talk about here. At least this will whet the listeners' interest, and we encourage them to go to your website, noufors.com. There'll be a link. If you go back to the program listing, there's a link there that will take you to Michel's website. Whether you speak English or French, it's in both languages there, because Michel is French-Canadian.
Apparently, I'm told it's the only bilingual website of its kind outside of Quebec.
Michel, thank you, sir.
Oh, you're welcome, my friend.
And we'll talk again soon.
Yes, you take care.
Yeah, and you too.
Okay.
You better pray to the Lord when you see those flying saucers. It may be the coming of the judgment day. It's a sign, there's no doubt, of the trouble that's about. So I say, my friend, you'd better start to pray.
And as I said at the outset of this edition of Strange Days Indeed, I'm going to wind it up with a taste of what UFO radio used to sound like. One of the more interesting aspects of this early radio program is that the Federal Communications Commission in the United States wouldn't allow two-way telephone conversations with listener call-ins. So Harve Morgan would take calls from listeners and then relay the question to the appropriate guest. This is a recording from the 12th of October, 1962. Earl J. Neff was the guest host, along with Rick Hilberg and Bob Miller of the United Saucer Council. The program was devoted to young ufologists and the Toledo Area Aerial Phenomena Investigations Bureau, the TAAPIB. Unfortunately, the opening sequence is missing. This recording comes from the Wendy Connors Faded Disc Collection.
Our falling star, and though the war may be true, there's unrest and trouble brewing, and those flying saucers may be just a sign that if peace doesn't come, it will be the end of some. So repent today, you're running out of time.
W. Westinghouse Radio in Cleveland, Ohio. This is Harve Morgan, and this is Program PM. I feel as though I should say this. The Mercury Theater of the Air, and this is your obedient servant. But no, we won't. I'm not very obedient, and not very servile either. But Bob Rove is along here, and it's going to be servile to the extent of answering your questions, along with Earl Neff, our ufology investigators. Now, I thought we would kind of set the stage for things tonight with that, I call it space-type music, because as I understand it, there has been a space sighting, and we'll get into that in just a moment. First, let me ask, as I always do, anything new in the way of outer spaceology, Earl? How's it been going?
Well, I learned of something today that looked pretty good, and when I checked it out, I found it was one of those fraud.
How's that?
Phonies, the hoaxes. A party called the Report Center, and from all appearances, it was on the level. And then I double-checked it and found the whole thing was a fraud.
Hmm.
So those are the things you must be very careful of, and we always go to great trouble to check them and double-check.
You don't just accept it on face value.
Not at all.
If someone says, I saw something purple up there, you do bother checking it out.
Right. This was just a crackpot.
Bob?
Well, as a matter of fact, a number of things have come by our way. Some very delightful, erudite, informed letters have been sent to us, as most of them, in fact, just about all of them always are. I want to thank, first of all, an armed forces man who feels that secrecy must be preserved if the objects are of a United States military nature.
Yeah, he had a good point in that letter.
Yes, that was an excellent point. Of course, his name is not to be mentioned, as he requested. I wish also to thank John Spanton, who wrote us. He is near Buffalo and listening this evening. Hello to him. We appreciate your very technical letter, and I will correspond with you, as you suggested, and hope in there. I want to thank also the Reverend Carlos Sparks from Tennessee. And so far as a citizens band network relating to UFO, our range would be far too short. And, of course, the time element of talking between stations would be restricted to 5 minutes, which just wouldn't be enough.
I think, Bob, that this brings up a very big point that I've been noticing the past few weeks, and that is that the mail that we've been getting on this UFO roundtable on Program PM has been coming in, I think, from much farther afield than anything that I've experienced before on PM during the course of the last year and a half. I mean, people have been commenting about and writing us their comments on the UFO Roundtable from all over the South, from all over New York, Pennsylvania. So wherever you are listening, believe me, we're interested in not only the fact that you are listening, but also in your reaction to the program, the Ufology Roundtable on Program PM. Let us hear from you wherever you are. We haven't heard yet from Alaska, have we?
No, that's one that we've missed, although we've heard most of this side of the United States.
I wonder if we beam up that way. Earl, do you have some...
I wish to thank those who sent me season's greetings. Quite a few mentioned their interest in the series of programs that KYW has been putting on here. And I'd personally like to thank you, Harv, and KYW for permitting Bob and myself to tell this listening audience, and it certainly is a great listening audience from judging from the response and from the areas from which we hear, permitting us to put on this series of what we believe is a very important subject, a subject of UFOs, unidentified flying objects. I received a...
Earl, let me just comment,
yes.
Because this being the beginning of a new year, I think that I would be lacking in my duties if I didn't... go above and beyond something we've been doing. All of the fellows here on KYW have been wishing everybody out there a happy new year and all. I think we should go beyond that, especially on this program. Everybody here, happy new year. And to all of you up there, if you are up there, we do wish you a happy new year. Although, I wonder if they have the same calendar. Well, I don't know. Anyway,
the Jews are down here.
let me check this, though, before we go too much further. We have some calls on the line. I'd like to take one or two of those, and then we're going to explore this unidentified flying object that was sighted yesterday. We'll tell you more about that in just a moment, but first let's do have a couple of questions here. What's yours, please? Professor Charles A. Meany, in a 1956 article published by the Flying Saucer Review. These people, when they ask questions, by golly, they've got sources, haven't they?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
That's excellent.
Yeah. He appealed to readers... and to researchers for an analysis of angel hair. Mm-hmm. Has any definite analysis been carried out to our knowledge? And if not, in a future recurrence, would it not be possible to get some of this substance called angel hair into a test tube before it dissolves and find out what it's all about? Well, let's find out. We've talked about angel hair before. Any comments on that?
Charles Meany is the professor at Defiance College, as I think we have mentioned before on the air.
I'd like to get him on the program, by the way.
I'd like very much to call him some evening, with your permission.
Okay.
The angel hair has, on numerous occasions, been picked up. And I remember one evening mentioning a friend of mine some years ago had gotten some downstate. That was when so much of it had been festooned from the wires, the telegraph wires, and the Air Force later said it was a certain spider had been working very hard at night in producing these webs. But the angel hair, when it's collected, doesn't last very long, either in your hands or in a bottle.
What is very long?
Well, it would only perhaps be just barely long enough to get it to a laboratory. It does leave your hands green or anything it touches. But physicist told me that he thought it was ionized air.
Bob, any comment on this?
This very well sums it up, as Earl has explained. My one source, Wilbert B. Smith, a physicist, superintendent of communications in Canada, on the board of transport, has analyzed angel hair, or has had angel hair analyzed, let's put it this way, and he also has found it to be ionized air.
This is the man that's going to create the seventh dimension or something.
He goes into about 12 of them.
Oh, with this little contraption that you showed me one time, he was going to turn it around and create what?
There was artificial gravity field generators, and we can go into quite a lengthy discussion.
We did one night.
We'll probably do it again on request.
Okay, thank you for calling. Let's take one more call. Program PM, what's your question, please? You're referring to Major Keogh's book, where he stated that the saucers were recorded on radar. They were recorded making 90-degree turns at approximately 5 to 9,000 miles an hour. You were talking with a friend where you work, and he said to make a 90-degree turn at the speed that we mentioned, 5,000 to 9,000 miles, this would be enough pressure to split an atom. And your question would be then, if this is possible, as stated, would there be an explosion at this 90-degree turn? And there'd be a force of approximately 16 million Gs, which is just about impossible for any matter to survive something like that. You'd like to find out about both these? Let's find out.
Well, I have seen on several occasions UFOs making 90-degree turns, not at the speeds you just mentioned. But I do know that they do the impossible, to us at least. Dr. Herman Oberth claimed that the reason they could do what they are doing is the fact that they are not only moving themselves through space, but with them, around them, they are surrounding themselves with these atmospheres, whatever you might wish to call them. In other words, you oftentimes do not even hear them because they're surrounded with best thing I can call it is atmosphere.
Creating their own atmosphere.
Creating
so to speak,
their own.
To negate ours.
Negate ours is correct, yeah.
Well, would not then this atmosphere in turn, because it is made up of atoms, would not this atmosphere in turn then be subject to this pressure? What do you think, Bob?
This is this idea of the tremendous, this is a function of momentum, not a function of the atmosphere through which it's the object itself is traversing. And anything, regardless whether it has its own atmospheric pressure or not, making a right angle turn with relation to a gravitational field with relation to a linear trajectory is going to experience tremendous change in momentum and a tremendous impact of momentum. Now, however, again, it has been suggested purely on a theoretical basis that it is the momentum itself, the idea that to the saucer itself or the object itself, there has been no change of direction. And this, again, the term field with relation to, that's probably one of the most abused terms in the entire vernacular of UFO research is field. But field indicates some invisible force mechanism surrounding. And it has been suggested then that the force fields that do surround UFOs possibly can produce a cushioning effect in these right angle turns.
I can see a guy, you know, going through this, and since the pressure would destroy his atmosphere that he's carrying with him, you know, zooming along, zip, zip, oh,
right,
just lost our atmosphere,
right,
fellas, and go back and pick it up.
But I might say this, Harv, that explosions are by no means unknown in the field of UFOs. And it is entirely possible, conceivable, that there are times when they do certain things that, like mentioned just on the phone, that would cause the explosion, because many times they have exploded.
Let me check now. Thank you very much for calling. Very good question. Let's talk now about this flying object that was sighted last night before we run completely out of time. Bob, could you place that call in while we...
Okay, will do. And, of course, as just a very brief review, this object was seen, of course, in the Ravenna area last night approximately, well, a little after 7:30, and the Akron Beacon Journal had it reported. KYW carried immediately the report over radio on news, and we're going to place the call now, then I'll go in.
You're going to call George?
Right.
Popovich?
Use line 40, if you will, okay?
Okay.
Now, what do you know about this thing that was cited last night?
Well, George called, George Popovich, who, by the way, is the director of the Akron UFO Research Committee and a very fine investigator, has been for years.
Reliable?
Very, very reliable. He called me at my home just before I left for the station tonight, and I told him to call here. Well, he got the call through before I arrived. But beyond what Bob just mentioned here from the news wires, I couldn't fill you in. I do know that he is perhaps by now, that is, I mean, Bob, George is perhaps by now at the home of the people who witnessed this.
Now, George himself did not see the flying
object. I do not believe so. But George, like the rest of us, frequently get the calls from here, there, and everywhere, and I presume that's what happened in this case. Incidentally, while we were waiting, might I say that I received an interesting letter from a former Air Force man, and I just spoke with him on the phone a moment ago and asked if he objected to my using his name.
Okay.
Alan Manick called, wrote me a bit short note, and in this, with his note, he has this information that I think is quite interesting. Paul Ziats, Ziats of Emory Drive in Cleveland, on the evening of December 1st, 1962, at about 9:15 p.m., relates this: a group of friends and myself were playing football in the backyards between Angle and Grossy Drive. As we were leaving, I saw the ground reflecting a very bright white light. It looked as if someone had turned on a giant fluorescent light above us. Suddenly, I had a warm sensation, whether it was from the light or a reaction within my body when I realized that the light might be extraterrestrial. I do not know. I turned around to see where the light was coming from. I looked up and saw a bright flash of light. It looked as if the object was moving across the sky and exploded. From what I could make out in the very short time I saw the light, it was moving north to south over the eastern sky. There was no sound whatsoever accompanying the light. After the disappearance of the light, everything got dark again, and there was no trace of any object or debris falling from the light. And at the time that this report was made, a very detailed account, of, by the way, has gone to NICAP in Washington, I received many other statements, and I was watching TV at the time, and the TV was full of snow. It never acted quite that badly, and this was at a NASA man's home when we were watching it.
So this then would seem to lead one to believe that there's something to this particular sighting on December 1st,
yes,
right?
Yes, I have quite a few reports on it. I hoped at the time to tell them, but time didn't permit.
Okay, now, let me knock another report in the teeth. We've been getting a lot of calls, Earl has and Bob has, I know, about a report of a sighting over Saskatchewan on the evening of December 24th. That was a week ago this past Monday. Now, people said, well, it was done in all seriousness and all like this, and yes, there was a sighting of an unidentified flying object December 24th reported on KYW-TV. Well, just to set the matter straight, this is true in a way, but since it's after, it's almost 11 o'clock at night, and I think most children are in bed, let's just report that this was not the kind of UFO that we're concerned with on this program. The report that Dick Goddard made was a true report. There was an object over Saskatchewan headed toward the Cleveland area that night, but it was nothing more than Santa Claus and his reindeers. And Dick Goddard, in all seriousness, truthfully, reported it. And don't you ever try to tell Dick Goddard that there's not a Santa Claus, or an Easter Bunny, for that matter. All right, now, we're going to get this report. Bob, is it all set up?
Yes, on the line right now, we have Mr. George Popovich, whom we've already introduced a moment ago. He will introduce the gentleman who made this sighting as we pick up line 40.
Okay, let me just check now, George.
Yeah.
This is Harv Morgan. Just to get this straight, did you see the flying
object
you saw?
No, I'm only investigating.
You have the people there ready to talk to you.
Yes, Mr. Carl Wright.
Okay, go ahead. We'll just listen to you then.
Well, I have with me tonight Mr. Carl Wright, that he and his wife and two other persons had observed what I have labeled as a UFO. And this occurred last evening approximately around 6 p.m. at Ravana, Ohio. So I would like to have you talk with Mr. Carl Rice, one of the observers. Carl?
Mr. Rice?
Hello,
Mr. Rice, could you describe in detail just exactly what you saw? Now, what time was this again you saw it?
Approximately 10 minutes to 6.
10 minutes to 6.
Yes, sir.
And what did you see?
Well, I saw a bright light, and it was standing still. It wasn't too bright. It was like a like an old-fashioned light bulb.
Mm-hmm.
And it stood still, and I took one of my employees home up to Rosemary, about, right there, half a mile, up across Highway 44. And as we got closer to it, it still was standing still. And then the light went out. Then this light came back on again. Went out again.
About how long did it stand still like that?
Well, approximately, I'd say about 15 minutes all told.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came back on, well, it didn't come back on the second third point. Mm-hmm. The red light came on, there was approximately 6 of them.
Mm-hmm.
That I could see in a crescent shape. And it made not exactly a circle, but kind of a quick turn and headed back, would be southeast.
So this turned from yellow in the beginning to red later, right?
Yes. There's approximately 6 lights that I can make out.
Is this conceivable? This is at Ravenna. Is it fairly hilly around there? Are there hilly areas?
And right where I am, there's nothing in there on top of the hill. Not a big hill, but a nice gravity site.
My thinking is this, and I'm just asking it in the realm of conceivability. Is it conceivable that this could have been what you saw over there, headlights parked somewhere, and then this would give the yellow effect through a haze? It was kind of foggy last night, and I remember driving home. And then later, the car may have turned around, backed up, and gone off in the other direction, which would have shown you their taillights. Is this possible?
Well, this is in the air. This is right over top by it.
But couldn't have been on a high hill somewhere, huh?
No, no, sir. Mm-hmm.
Who have you reported this to? Have you reported to the Air Force?
No, I reported to the record carrier and they reported for Action Beacon Journal.
All right. Right now, let me, because I know that Bob Grover and Earl probably have some questions that investigating nature that they would like to ask you. So let me turn you over right now to Bob Rowe for any questions that he might have. Mr. Rice? Okay, fine. Good evening, Mr. Rice. Okay, this is the part I missed is how much overhead, for example, did this thing go? Did it have a trajectory immediately overhead or was it pretty much in the horizon?
Well, it was up overhead from where we tried to make a turn, you know.
Mm, it was just about overhead. Well, that would rule out anything being on a nearby hill. That's what I was wondering.
No.
Did you hear any noise?
Not a single noise of any kind.
Oh, okay. Did you notice any interference with any radio, any lighting, anything like that?
Well, we have occasional interference of all kinds,
obviously. At the trailer park,
yeah? Oh, yeah.
But nothing undue, nothing unusual as an actual physical effect was noticed, is that right?
No, sir.
Okay, hang on. We'll pass this over now to Earl Neff.
Good day, Mr. Rice. That was Earl Neff speaking. Bob pretty much covered it. I did want to ask you one question, however. Did the light seem to pulse?
No.
Faint?
Mm-hmm.
It was constant?
It was constant.
Okay. I see.
That was the red and the white light.
The red being at the upper part, perhaps?
Well, the white light went out, seeing the red came on.
I see. In other words, it interchanged.
That's right.
Thank you very much. I'm going to turn you back to Harv Morgan.
Yes.
Mr. Rice, this may sound like a lawyer talk, but were there any corroborating witnesses on this? Did anyone see it with you?
Well, it was two of my employees. One was at the barn, rode along with me up there. I have a car in the garage, and we went and stopped and see about that.
Mm-hmm.
He rode along with me. And then John Conkle, which was along with me, two of my employees.
Mm-hmm. And then three people saw the same thing. Do you all agree on what you saw?
And my wife saw it from the window, but all she saw was a white light, because she didn't pay much attention to it. She thought it was an awful big fire, but I don't think it was.
Is that a fairly populated area out there?
Well, it was a big fire last night.
No, I said, is it fairly populated with people out there?
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of anybody else also witnessing this phenomenon?
No, I haven't. Not yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps someone hearing us talk about it tonight, has seen that, and I hope it's not the power of suggestion working on them. If you have, call us at 241-5637. We'd like to find out about it if we have time to get to your call before the program is off the air tonight. Do you intend to tell the Air Force about this, Mr. Rice?
Well, I don't know whether I should or not.
If you do, and I wish you would you let us get back with you next week again and find out what their reaction has been to your report?
Yes, sir.
Would you do that? And would you let the Air Force know about it then?
No, surprise.
Okay. Let me ask Earl or Bob, who should he call at the Air Force to notify them about this? Where would be the nearest place to call?
Well, Wright Patterson and
Wright
Maiden
Patterson would
be
your best,
receive,
yes.
Yeah.
Either
Wright.
Major Lieutenant Colonel Green perhaps would be the better.
What's the other gentleman we talked to?
I beg your pardon.
Yeah, Friend.
Or Colonel Green. Colonel Green or...
Which one we had on the program that time?
That was Friend, I believe.
Friend,
all right,
yes.
And I call Lieutenant Colonel Friend at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Lieutenant Colonel Friend.
Okay.
Former Major.
That's in Dayton, and I'd be very interested to find out his comments. All right?
What's the name, please?
Lieutenant Colonel Friend.
Friend,
yes. At Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Right.
That's down in Dayton. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Rice. Appreciate your comments.
Okay.
You follow to your round table. Bye.
Well, I'd like to find out more about
very
that.
Good.
Probably by next week, we'll have quite a beauty to present on the air on whatever happens on this. I'm looking forward to the information coming in.
Maybe we can get something tonight at 241-5637 if anyone has heard about that. Let me take one more telephone question here. These people have been hanging on very closely. Can you stand by, please? Program PM, this is the Ufology Roundtable. What's your question, please? Why won't the Air Force tell all they know? And if it's from a higher kind of human being, why won't somebody let the public know? Well, I think this is a question that really can't be answered, so I won't present it to our investigators here. We've learned it before. We don't know why. There are those that say the Air Force is telling all that they do know. Most people, certainly those Bob and Earl, I don't think agree with that. But thank you for calling anyway. Program PM, your question, please. Are there any special times when the UFOs are sighted in this area? Has this been mostly a night thing or what?
No. The only thing I can say there is at night, naturally, anything that's bright in the sky is going to be more visible than it is in the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, as far as sightings are concerned, I have seen as many in the daytime as I have at night, and I think that would be universally accepted over.
Let me put a twist on this question. Are there more sightings when the moon is full? I'm serious. I'm serious, are there? You know, you talk to bartenders and you will say, oh boy, I've read those full moon nights. You got some real weirdos in here.
Well,
you know?
Actually, a full moon night is not the best night to look for UFOs because it's too bright.
There's too much glare, the same way.
Yes, I would much rather look on a night when there is not a full moon.
Mm.
There are other things to do on a full moon night.
The actual time of day has little to do with it, though, except at night you can see that.
Right.
Okay, thank you for calling. And we just have a couple minutes left. Earl, I think there's something you wanted to comment on.
Well, I wanted to say that, getting back to the letters and comments, a Doug Kenny, who was traveling in Pennsylvania in the mountains, said that on his car radio he was catching last week's broadcast very clearly. And then I received a letter. I don't know how these people get my name or a correct address, but it gets to me, from a Timothy Green Beckley from New Brunswick, New Jersey. And he starts, but I'll just read this first line. Dear Mr. Neff, this is just a short letter to let you know I enjoyed very much listening to you on KYW's PM show last night. And then he writes this full letter, which is very interesting. Another letter I received from a Bill Engel. Says, I heard your broadcast and was impressed with the arguments you gave in behalf of the existence of flying saucers. I haven't given much thought to them since the fur died down. I presume he means back in 47. I have read some of the Major Kehoe's writings and I have an open mind on the subject. There has been much confusion involved with the reports of unidentified objects. Every time a sighting is made, there is an instant clamoring of ridicule and denials. It has seemed to me that the extent to which the derriers go to cast doubt on the reports adds credence to the claims. I'm not intelligent enough to understand complex matters, so I've taken a sort of agnostic stand. I don't know for sure. Therefore, I can form no opinion until I find out. And so on and so forth. And signs it Bill Engel.
We're just about out of time now. Unfortunately, this is always the case. Bob, any final comments?
Yes, I'd like to wish some fellows in Toledo, Phil Urbanski's group, best of luck in their new UFO organization. I'd have some other... many other questions which I have been unable to get to. Let me sum up by saying that we will answer these questions next week on the air that were directed personally to our group, plus the fact that naturally here at 241-5637, both Earl and myself will be very happy to answer questions as they come in after program time. We'll both be here next week to follow up on this very recent UFO sighting, as well as some more of the letters, which I'm sure will continue to come in.
Don't forget that number is 241-5637. You can still call and you can still get answers. Bob and Earl will both stick around.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door, all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob.
And that's SDI number 464. Thank you for listening, thank you for subscribing, and look forward again to being in your ears.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. The splotch, the blotch, be careful.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.